Chapter 36. Don't you know them? I know hardly any poetry, he replied mournfully. Don't you? These are some of them. There was a being whom my spirit oft met on its vision wanderings far aloft. A seraph of heaven, too gentle to be human, veiling beneath that radiant form of woman. Oh, it is too flattering, so I won't go on. But say it's me. Say it's me. It is you, dear, exactly like you. Now I forgive you. And you shall kiss me just once there, not very long. She put the tip of her finger gingerly to her cheek, and he did as commanded. You do care for me very much, don't you, in spite of my not you know? Yes, sweet, he said with a sigh, and bade her good night. Vi, in returning to his native town of Shaston as schoolmaster Phillotson had won the interest, and awakened the memories of the inhabitants, who, though they did not honor him for his miscellaneous acquirements as he would have been honored elsewhere, retained for him a sincere regard. When, shortly after his arrival, he brought home a pretty wife awkwardly pretty for him, if he did not take care, they said they were glad to have her settle among them. For some time after her flight from that home, Sue's absence did not excite comment. Her place as monitor in the school was taken by another young woman within a few days of her vacating it, which substitution also passed without remark, Sue's services having been of a provisional nature only. When, however, a month had passed, and Phillotson casually admitted to an acquaintance that he did not know where his wife was staying, curiosity began to be aroused, till, jumping to conclusions, people ventured to affirm that Sue had played him false and run away from him. The schoolmaster's growing languor and listlessness over his work gave countenance to the idea. Though Phillotson had held his tongue as long as he could, except to his friend Gillingham, his honesty and directness would not allow him to do so when misapprehensions as to Sue's conduct spread abroad. On a Monday morning the chairman of the school committee called, and after attending to the business of the school, drew Phillotson aside out of earshot of the children. You'll excuse my asking, Phillotson, since everybody is talking of it. Is this true, as to your domestic affairs, that your wife's going away was on no visit, but a secret elopement with a lover? If so, I condole with you. Don't, said Phillotson. Here was no secret about it. As he has gone to visit friends? No. Then what has happened? As he has gone away under circumstances that usually call for condolence with the husband. But I gave my consent. The chairman looked as if he had not apprehended the remark. What I say is quite true, Phillotson continued testily. She asked leave to go away with her lover, and I let her. Why shouldn't I? A woman of full age, it was a question of her own conscience, not for me. I was not her galler. I can't explain any further. I don't wish to be questioned. The children observed that much seriousness marked the faces of the two men, and went home, and told their parents that something new had happened about Mrs. Phillotson. Then Phillotson's little maidservant, who was a schoolgirl just out of her standards, said that Mr. Phillotson had helped in his wife's packing, had offered her what money she required, and had written a friendly letter to her young man, telling him to take care of her. The chairman of committee thought the matter over, and talked to the other managers of the school, till a request came to Phillotson to meet them privately. The meeting lasted a long time, and at the end the schoolmaster came home, looking as usual pale and worn. Gillingham was sitting in his house awaiting him. Well, it is as you said, observed Phillotson, flinging himself down wearily in a chair. They have requested me to send in my resignation on account of my scandalous conduct in giving my tortured wife her liberty, or, as they call it, condoning her adultery. But I shan't resign. I think I would. I won't. It is no business of theirs. It doesn't affect me in my public capacity at all. They may expel me if they like. If you make a fuss it will get into the papers, and you will never get appointed to another school. You see, they have to consider what you did as done by a teacher of youth, and its effects as such upon the morals of the town. And, to ordinary opinion, your position is indefensible. You must let me say that. To this good advice, however, Phillotson would not listen. I don't care, he said. Don't go unless I am turned out. And for this reason, that by resigning I acknowledge I have acted wrongly by her, when I am more and more convinced every day that in the sight of heaven, and by all natural, straightforward humanity, I have acted rightly. Gillingham saw that his rather headstrong friend would not be able to maintain such a position as this, but he said nothing further, and in due time indeed, in a quarter of an hour the formal letter of dismissal arrived, the managers having remained behind to write it after Phillotson's withdrawal. The latter replied that he should not accept dismissal, and called a public meeting, which he attended, although he looked so weak and ill that his friend implored him to stay at home. When he stood up to give his reasons for contesting the decision of the managers, he advanced them firmly, as he had done to his friend, and contended, moreover, that the matter was a domestic theory which did not concern them. This they overruled, insisting that the private eccentricities of a teacher came quite within their sphere of control, as it touched the morals of those he taught. Phillotson replied that he did not see how an act of natural charity could injure morals. All the respectable inhabitants and well-to-do fellow natives of the town were against Phillotson to a man. But, somewhat to his surprise, some dozen or more champions rose up in his defense, as from the ground. It has been stated that Shaston was the anchorage of a curious and interesting group of itinerants, who frequented the numerous fairs and markets held up and down Wessex during the summer and autumn months. Although Phillotson had never spoken to one of these gentlemen, they now nobly led the forlorn hope in his defense. The body included two cheap jacks, a shooting gallery proprietor and the ladies who loaded the guns, a pair of boxing masters, a steam roundabout manager, two traveling broom makers, who called themselves widows, a gingerbread stall keeper, a swingboat owner, and a steer strength man. This generous phalanx of supporters, and a few others of independent judgment, whose own domestic experiences had been not without vicissitude, came up and warmly shook hands with Phillotson, after which they expressed their thoughts so strongly to the meeting that issue was joined, the result being a general scuffle, wherein a blackboard was split, three panes of the school windows were broken, an ink bottle was spilled over a town councillor's shirt front, a churchwarden was dealt such a topper with the map of Palestine that his head went right through Samaria, and many black eyes and bleeding noses were given, one of which, to everybody's horror, was the venerable incumbent's, owing to the zeal of an emancipated chimney sweep, who took the side of Phillotson's party. When Phillotson saw the blood running down the rector's face, he deplored almost in groans the untoward and degrading circumstances, regretted that he had not resigned when called upon, and went home so ill that next morning he could not leave his bed. The farcical yet melancholy event was the beginning of a serious illness for him, and he lay in his lonely bed in the pathetic state of mind of a middle-aged man who perceives at length that his life, intellectual and domestic, is tending to failure and gloom. Gillingham came to see him in the evenings, and on one occasion mentioned Sue's name. "She doesn't care anything about me," said Phillotson. "Why should she? She doesn't know you are ill. So much the better for both of us. Where are her lover and she living?" "At Melchester, I suppose. At least he was living there some time ago." When Gillingham reached home, he sat and reflected, and at last wrote an anonymous line to Sue, on the bare chance of its reaching her, the letter being enclosed in an envelope addressed to Jude at the diocesan capital. Arriving at that place, it was forwarded to Mary Green in North Wessex, and thence to Aldbrickham by the only person who knew his present address, the widow who had nursed his aunt. 3 days later, in the evening, when the sun was going down in splendor over the lowlands of Blackmoor, and making the Shaston windows like tongues of fire to the eyes of the rustics in that vale, the sick man fancied that he heard somebody come to the house, and a few minutes after there was a tap at the bedroom door. Phillotson did not speak. The door was hesitatingly opened, and there entered Sue. She was in light spring clothing, and her advent seemed ghostly like the flitting in of a moth. He turned his eyes upon her, and flushed, but appeared to check his primary impulse to speak. "I have no business here," she said, bending her frightened face to him. "But I heard you were ill, very ill, and as I know that you recognize other feelings between man and woman than physical love, I have come. I am not very ill, my dear friend. Only unwell. I didn't know that, and I am afraid that only a severe illness would have justified my coming. Yes. Yes. And I almost wish you had not come. It is a little too soon, that's all I mean. Still, let us make the best of it. You haven't heard about the school, I suppose? Know what about it? Only that I am going away from here to another place. The managers and I don't agree, and we are going to part, that's all." Sue did not for a moment, either now or later, suspect what troubles had resulted to him from letting her go. It never once seemed to cross her mind, and as he had received no news whatever from Shaston. They talked on slight and ephemeral subjects, and when his tea was brought up he told the amazed little servant that a cup was to be set for Sue. That young person was much more interested in their history than they supposed, and as she descended the stairs she lifted her eyes and hands in grotesque amazement. While they sipped, Sue went to the window and thoughtfully said, "It is such a beautiful sunset, Richard. They are mostly beautiful from here, owing to the rays crossing the mist of the vale. But I lose them all, as they don't shine into this gloomy corner where I lie. Wouldn't you like to see this particular one? It is like heaven opened." "Ah, yes. But I can't. I'll help you to. No, the bedstead can't be shifted. But see how I mean." She went to where a swing glass stood, and taking it in her hands carried it to a spot by the window, where it could catch the sunshine, moving the glass till the beams were reflected into Phillotson's face. "There you can see the great red sun now," she said. "And I am sure it will cheer you, I do so hope it will." She spoke with a childlike, repentant kindness, as if she could not do too much for him. Phillotson smiled sadly. "You are an odd creature," he murmured as the sun glowed in his eyes. "The idea of your coming to see me, after what has passed." "Don't let us go back upon that," she said quickly. "I have to catch the omnibus for the train. As Jude doesn't know I have come, he was out when I started, so I must return home almost directly. Richard, I am so very glad you are better. You don't hate me, do you? You have been such a kind friend to me." "I am glad to know you think so," said Phillotson huskily. "No, I don't hate you." It grew dusk quickly in the gloomy room during their intermittent chat, and when candles were brought, and it was time to leave, she put her hand in his, or rather allowed it to flit through his, for she was significantly light in touch. As he had nearly closed the door when he said, "Sue," he had noticed that, in turning away from him, tears were on her face and a quiver in her lip. It was bad policy to recall her, he knew it, while he pursued it. But he could not help it. She came back. "Sue," he murmured, "do you wish to make it up, and stay? I'll forgive you and condone everything." "Oh, you can't," she said hastily. "Who can't condone it now? He is your husband now, in effect, you mean, of course? You may assume it. He is obtaining a divorce from his wife Arabella." "His wife? It is altogether news to me that he has a wife. It was a bad marriage. Like yours. Like mine. He is not doing it so much on his own account as on hers. She wrote and told him it would be a kindness to her, since then she could marry and live respectably. And Judas agreed." Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.